from KQED.
This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. When President Obama used Martin Luther King Jr.'s Bible at his second inaugural swearing-in, talk show host Tavis Smiley said he hoped the president would continue Dr. King's legacy by tackling poverty. Tavis Smiley is running a national anti-poverty campaign along with professor and activist Cornel West, a political commentator and talk host on PBS, as well as host with Cornel West of his show on PRI. He's the author of Fail Up, 20 Lessons on Building Success from Failure, which we discussed on Forum, and he joins us for this Forum segment. And Tavis, good to have you back with us. Welcome.
How are you, sir?
I'm okay, and you are busy and as involved in as many things, multitasking as usual. I've been trying to get you on for a while, but I know this campaign has been going on. It's taken up a lot of you and Cornell's time. I wanted to kind of use the book here, because when we talked about the book, you were talking about how important it is to fail sometimes in order to succeed or to go through failure, thus the fail up from Beckett. I'm curious how that might even tie in with this campaign, because you've been trying to bring attention to the White House, to the 50 million people who are in poverty in this country, and it's been, well, a success in some ways getting grassroots organization, but a failure in terms of getting the president's ear.
Yeah, you know, on the in the recent State of the Union address, he finally got around to talking about poverty more than he has in any other time in his presidency, and he hit the road after the speech and made a number of appearances where he talked about what the media broadly labeled his anti-poverty agenda. So the fact that he got around to even talking about it, to uttering the word and to giving voice to the struggle and to the invisibility of those persons living in poverty was important. But clearly there's so much more to be done. The reality is that the poor are rendered more and more invisible in this country because they don't contribute to campaigns, because they don't vote at the level of the elite, because they don't have lobbyists up and down K Street in Washington. And so because of political greed and corporate indifference, the poor just they just don't rate. And I fear, as we sit for this conversation now, on the eve of what appears to be the kick-in of sequestration and automatic budget cuts, say nothing about the larger conversation about, austerity, as far as I'm concerned. Poor people are in trouble in this country.
You and Cornell have been highly critical up until the State of the Union address, and particularly wanting the president to convene and to go after poverty and get experts together and do some things that really are substantive. And at this point, are you more hopeful because of the inauguration address?
Well, the short answer is this president, respectfully, has always been good at giving great speeches. And I suspect that if you talk to persons who rate and rank his speeches, his recent State of the Union address would go down as one of his top five. And it was wonderfully delivered and well written. And again, it's not about what you say; it's about what you do. And so we're anxious to see what the president is really going to do in terms of pushing an anti-poverty agenda. He has not come nowhere near channeling Lyndon Johnson when it comes to really establishing and being the general, if you will, of a war on poverty. He hasn't come anywhere near that. When he talked about raising the federal minimum wage the other night at the speech a couple weeks ago now, He talked about raising it to $9 an hour. Now, the last time the president talked about raising the federal minimum wage, Michael, it was his talking about raising it to $9.50 an hour. Now, even $9.50 is nowhere near where we would be in terms of, $9.1068 levels. We'd have to at least be at, if we went back to $9.1968 levels, we'd be, I think the number's like at $22. So we know that's not going to happen. But the last time he talked about it, he said $9.50, and now he says $9. So once again, he's negotiating against himself. The real debate hasn't even begun yet, but at least now that the president has talked about this and put it out publicly, I hope the Democrats, who have been so milquetoast and spineless on raising the minimum wage, which I think ought to be a living wage, but I hope now that he's at least broached the subject, that the Democrats can at least start to talk about it openly and do something about really getting serious about raising the level of the minimum wage in this country.
Well, when you mentioned LBJ, of course, I think of the fact that he was a Southerner and he had certain abilities like Nixon might have had in terms of going to China. And you just went to China. I know I want to talk with you about that. But the fact of the matter is also, he had a lot of control over the Congress. This president doesn't.
Well, see, you're right about that. He has been up against a headwind, no doubt about it. He has not had the kind of tailwind that I or others would have loved to see him have. Having said that, it's always important to remind the country that for the first 2 years when he took over as president in his first term, he had the House and the Senate. And the Democrats were woefully lacking in terms of what they got accomplished in those first 2 years. So it's easy for people to talk about the obstructionist agenda he's been up against, the headwind he's had to, you know, try to fly against. And I get that, and I agree with that. But what about those first 2 years where they didn't get much of anything done when he did have control of the House and the Senate? And moreover, he might not have the House or the Senate, but he has the American people behind him. This guy was the winner. And at the end of the day, you have to draw a line in the sand and say, you know, I am not crossing this line. As my granddad said, you know, there's some fights that ain't worth fighting even if you win, but there are other fights that you have to fight even if you lose. And I think what the American people want to see is this president is willing to fight. He's certainly been more progressive, more aggressive, probably a better word, since he's gotten reelected. But the real question is going to be in the coming days and weeks and months, how strong will his spine, how stiff will his spine be beyond the rhetoric?
Well, you know, I'm thinking about recent YouTube, exploration of the Obama presidency with Jesse Jackson, and he was saying, well, he got health care through. He's getting us out of Afghanistan and Iraq. Got Detroit back on its heels. Got the economy back on track. No mention of drones. No mention of poverty. No mention of anything like that. Reverend Jackson sees him as looking pretty polished.
I think given the alternative of what Mr. Romney would have represented or Mr. McCain would have represented, and I'm not saying that because I'm trying to be deliberately partisan. I'm saying if you look at what Mitt Romney had to say during the campaign about what he thought about the 47% and what he thought about the poor, these are his own words that came back to haunt him and allow him to get so pummeled and just outright, you know, trumped and trounced, as it were, in that election. So he's so much better than the alternative, and I think some of that is inherent in what Reverend Jackson is saying. But to the larger point that you raised, this conversation about drones that had really been non-existent, some of us have been beating this drum for a long time, but this conversation was really non-existent until John Brennan got nominated, and we'll see how that kind of works out. And even still, the betting in Washington is that he will get through. After all of this, the betting is he will still get through. So the drone conversation and the secrecy surrounding that and the innocent women and children being killed, that conversation may not yield much at the end of the day, number one. You're right. In no real agenda as yet with teeth where poor people are concerned. So I'm willing to give the president a chance to, you know, to do more in the second term than he did the first time on gun control. I mean, the Brady campaign gave him an F in his first term on gun control. And so now, after Sandy Hook, we see, you know, the president and the vice president have gotten more serious about this. But ultimately, if this is what it takes, if Sandy Hook is what it takes to get us at a real conversation about gun control, you had Gabby Giffords in the first term as the poster child for gun control. She was a Democrat. When the Democrats controlled both houses again, and they did nothing about gun control, one of their own almost lost her life, they did nothing. And so I just don't know what it's going to take for us to light a fire under Democrats, under the White House, and just quite frankly under leaders across the country to take the plight of poor people more seriously.
Talking with talk show host and political commentator Tavis Smiley, who is on PBS as well as the Tavis Smiley Show and Smiley and West on PRI, and he's the author of Fail Up, 20 Lessons on Building Success from Failure, which is now in trade paperback, and also spent the last 2 years really crisscrossing the country with Professor Cornel West to start a national conversation on the issue of poverty, most recently asking President Obama to organize a White House conference on eradication of poverty in America. This is an opportunity for you to join this conversation, and let me tell you how you can do that. I want to give out our toll-free number to you so you can put in your thoughts or any questions or comments you might have for Tavis Smiley. The number is 866-733-6786, and we welcome your calls now. Again, toll-free, you can join us at 866-733-6786. You can also, of course, email us, our email address, forum@kqed.org, or post any questions or comments immediately onto our website by going to kqed.org/forum and clicking on this segment. And you can go to our Facebook page or tweet us, our Twitter handle, @KQEDForum, but we'd certainly like to hear from you about your concerns where poverty is concerned. And do you think the Obama administration has simply managed to lie down on this and is not doing enough and not doing nearly what it could be doing. That's been certainly the message of the campaign you and Cornell have been involved in, Tavis. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering about all the blowback on this. I mean, you know, there are those, and some of this coming from the black press, coming from the black press, calling you the Bash Brothers and saying it's the wrong tone to take and that you two felt snubbed by the White House and that's what this is really all about. Your thoughts?
Hear me chuckling. It's kind of funny. This stuff, I'm laughing, but this after a while, it does take its toll. There's no doubt about it. This kind of stuff hurts, and you don't want to be treated in this way, maltreated in this way by the people that you have given your life to sort of loving and serving. So it doesn't feel good on the one hand. On the other hand, you know, you've got to be true to your own convictions, and you've got to, to stand, as it were, in your own truth. And what I find funny about it, which is what brought the chuckle on, when you mentioned that some of this is a lot of this has come from the black press, that is correct. What's funny about this is that my white progressive friends in the Bay Area, or in the New York Times, or in the Washington Post, or on the internet, you know, Frank Rich, Maureen Dow, Tom Friedman, Paul Krugman, Arianna Huffington. I mean, run the list. My white progressive friends can offer the same critique of the president that I offer or that Cornel West offers, and they don't get taken to task for that. Or they, quite frankly, get labeled as being courageous to stand up to the president and telling what he ought to be doing more of. But when Dr. West and I do that, inside of the black community at least, you know, you get this kind of negative commentary, which, again, I'm not naive. I understand in part comes from the fact that the black community is the president's most loyal constituency, and therein lies the irony. Because we are the president's most loyal constituency, we should not be at the end of the line, or, pardon the pun, at the back of the bus when it comes to getting the concerns and needs of our community addressed. And that's not to suggest that we ought to get the hookup because we're African-American. Again, this is the most loyal constituency the president has ever had. So the gays and lesbians can get his attention, and I'm glad they did. Wall Street certainly doesn't just get his attention. They seem to own this White House. They're bought and bossed by Wall Street, so they certainly have his attention. The Israeli lobby has gotten his attention, and I'm not mad at them either. I think that that's what happens. Constituencies have to speak their truth. They've got to press their case and their cause.
But you're talking about constituencies. Excuse me. You're talking about constituencies, yes, as you indicated earlier, that have resources to make their voices more heard.
Yeah, but black people have resources not at the level that some constituencies do, but all those constituencies I just listed and others learned how to protest from us. They learned how to raise their voices. The Negro, the black national anthem, as you know, is what? Lift every voice and sing. We taught the world how to protest, and so we have so often been used, quite frankly, as the litmus test for the success of any constituency's argument against whatever, you know, victimization they're up against. So we know how to do this. We've taught the world how to do it. We've just laid down, quite frankly, out of deference to this particular president.
Well, you know my abiding fondness for Cornel West. We've known each other for many, many years.
Sure, sure.
But what about when he says something like when he describes the president of the United States as a Rockefeller Republican in blackface?
Dr. West and I have been brothers for a long time, and there is no daylight between the two of us when it comes to our love and our service to all of humanity, not just black people. Dr. West has his own unique way of expressing himself, and I have my way of expressing myself, and I don't critique him. He doesn't critique me in terms of how we express ourselves, because that's what we do in terms of trying to raise the bar on these conversations. So one can take any liberty they want to pick apart what he says. What I encourage people to do is to get at the point that he is attempting to make. What he was trying to say is that you have an African, and I don't speak for Cornel West, he does it much better than I could ever do it. What he was trying to say was, here you have an African-American president who ought to know better, who ought to understand the plight of the people that we're trying to speak on behalf of. And rather than being progressive, he acts as if he's a Rockefeller Republican. So one can pick apart the word, pick apart the language, the flow and the style and the verse. But ultimately, if one gets at the heart of what Dr. West was trying to say, I think his point is valid, that you have an African-American president who people thought would be more progressive, would be more aggressive, as I said earlier, who thought that these concerns would be higher up on his agenda.
Just had come into my consciousness, Tavis, memory of you and Cornell being on with Bill O'Reilly.
Uh-huh.
At one point, he said something very pointed about nobody on Wall Street deserving to be prosecuted. Nobody had been prosecuted. Yeah, the both of you not only laughed, but you went, whoa, you know, your hands went up in the air. I mean, it was quite a dramatic response to that. Does the problem go beyond the president? Does the problem go to just the whole political system, the way things are wired and the kind of lobbying that goes on and so forth that just, again, neglects poor people?
There is no doubt about it. I mean, the system is wired. The system is wired against poor people. The deck is stacked against poor people. You know, pick your metaphor. That's essentially what we're up against, that the poor just don't seem to matter in this country. At worst, they're a complete afterthought. At best, they are a political calculation for a speech or for a campaign. But at the end of the day, we have not made the eradication of poverty a priority in this country. And so what Dr. West and I have called for is for a White House conference on the eradication of poverty that you referenced earlier. What does that mean? It means bringing together the experts in this country, the poverty experts, and I don't consider myself one. I'm passionate about this issue, but I'm not an expert. But certainly there are experts all across this country that you and I know and have talked to and interviewed over the course of our careers who know this stuff frontwards and backwards, from the left and the right. They ought to be invited to the White House for a conference to sit with the president and his top advisors and craft a national plan to cut poverty in half in 10 years, to eradicate it in 25. This is not a skill problem. It's a will problem. We just don't have the will to do it. This country can do anything, Michael, that it puts its mind to. We just have not made the eradication of poverty again a priority.
Let me go to your calls, and we'll begin, Catherine, with you. Good morning.
Hello, I'm a teacher in inner city Oakland, and I'm wondering how does education impact your fight on poverty? Because I don't see a whole lot of interest in the kids in excelling at education, and I wonder how that could change.
It's a powerful question. In our book that we've recently written, The Rich and the Rest of Us, that's the book that Dr. West and I have written together. We both have written books, of course, separately, Michael, but we've never co-authored a text, but this one's out now. It's called The Rich and the Rest of Us, The Poverty Manifesto. We take that issue head on in the book. Indeed, Dr. West sat down for a conversation for the book with the Education Secretary, Arne Duncan, and we've talked to others. But we talk about this issue very clearly and very quickly because there's no doubt a link between education and poverty. The one thing that everybody in Washington, on the left and the right, Republicans and Democrats, agree on is this link between education and poverty. The question is, what do we do about that? And there's no doubt in my mind that whether the school is public or private, inner city or suburban, the schools that do best in this country are the schools where parents are involved. And so we challenge African-American parents in these inner cities to get involved in the education of their children. Having said that, there are some institutional barriers, some institutional structures that these parents are up against that make doing this successfully not the easiest task in the world. It's the reason why, Michael, for the last 3 or 4 years now, I have taken to doing these primetime specials on PBS beyond my regular late-night show. I do these primetime specials, and I've focused a lot on education. The next one airs, I believe, on March the 23rd. I came to the Bay Area to film, as a matter of fact, for this special in Oakland. It airs March the 23rd in primetime, 8 o'clock. I believe on PBS. That's a Tuesday night, March 23rd. It's called Education Under Arrest. Education Under Arrest. When we take this issue head on, I hope you'll get a chance to check it out.
No, I'm glad you could mention it for the listener's sake. And I had mentioned China before, and you're doing a film on China, I understand. And I mean, the poverty there is far more appalling than it is here.
It is. I mean, you think about it. I spent a lot of time there. I've been there 2 or 3 times now, and on this kind of work and this project. And what I've learned is that, and I chose China in part because it is regarded now as the U.S. and China are the richest nations in the world, and there are many believe that if the last century belonged to us, this century belongs to China. We'll see. But the question I really wanted to get at is: China, are they actually wealthy? Or are they poor? Are they a wealthy nation? Or are they a poor nation? It depends on how you define that. But when you go to China with their, 4, 5, 6 billion people, what you realize is obviously there are a whole lot more poor people in China than there are wealthy people in China. So is China really a wealthy nation or is it a poor nation? And on whose backs is China? Or has China become this wealthy nation? And what you see is that poverty, again, is not just a domestic issue in the richest nation in the history of the world, our country, but it's also a worldwide issue. And so there are worldwide implications to poverty that have a lot to do with U.S. policy and trade policy and global policy. So the linkages are you know, the tentacles are everywhere, but I want to spend some time in that country to get a look at how poverty exists in a country that we seem to regard as the wealthiest in the world.
So as you get out of the cities, right? There it is, right in front of you.
You see it in the cities, and you move beyond the places where the tourists go. It's clearly in the cities, but when you go out into to your point, when you get outside the cities, as you well know, Lord, the poverty of those migrant workers, and you talk about kids trying to get an education, and what they have to go through, and where they the squalor that they live in, and it's mind-boggling to see that part of China that China, for obvious reasons, doesn't show to the rest of the world, but they've started to do that. And one of the reasons why I wasn't naive, one of the reasons why they opened up to me and gave me such access that really hadn't been given to other, you know, American reporters and hosts, the reason why they gave me so much access is because they want to change that narrative a little bit. They want to take some heat off of them, Michael, about how wealthy they are and get the world to see, hey, we've got real problems here. And so they opened up the doors to me to see some other stuff, and it's a narrative that they want to, I think, they for their own political reasons, they want to advance as well, that we do have issues that we have to face in our own country.
Again, Tavis Smiley with us by phone this morning from Los Angeles, author of Fail Up, 20 Lessons on Building Success from Failure, now in trade paperback. And let's hear from Margo joining us from East Oakland. Hi, Margo.
Hi. And I just wanted to thank you, as always, and Mr. Smiley. I am so grateful. Last night, I was feeling a little blue, and I tuned into Tavis Smiley's show in the middle of the night and heard Taj Mahal and that warm, wonderful conversation. And today, here you are. I mean, I went to Ivy League schools, had a wonderful career for nonprofits in retirement, am now in the lowest quarter of the poverty level. And there are, and it's things like this program and Tavis Smiley that make life hopeful.
No, first of all, that you just made my day. I feel the love, and I thank you for two quick things. One, what I love about doing the PBS show, Michael, we are actually in our 10th season now. As a matter of fact, I was in a meeting half of the day yesterday. We're in our 10th season, and we're moving toward our 2,000th show. I'm the first person of color, believe it or not, Michael, the first person of color in the history of PBS to have his own show, and that just started 10 years ago. And I was the first person of color to have his own show on NPR, and that just happened 12 or 13 years ago. Shows you, again, how much more work we have to do, even in progressive mediums like PBS and NPR. Having said that, we're in our 10th season, pushing toward our 2,000th show. We got a big plan for a big event, a big week of programming that we're doing in May as we get to our 2,000th show, which is a pretty big deal in this business. But I was saying to my staff yesterday how much I love still doing it after 10 years, because I get a chance to talk about so many different issues and to talk to so many different people. So to hear that she tuned in last night, to hear this musician that many of us have always loved but has never been on PBS, Taj Mahal, was a great conversation. I should add it very quickly. Somebody just emailed me and told me while I was on the phone with you that I gave the wrong date. The PBS special that I mentioned, Education Under Arrest, it does air on a Tuesday night, but that would be March the 26th, not the 23rd. So my mistake.
Okay, we've got that straight. And you are getting a lot of love here. Listener writes on our website, Tavis is unbelievably sharp. Why is he one of the so few Americans to tell it like it is? Love him for cutting through all the administration's excuses, Tavis. You are so tough. Hang in there. We love you.
Thank you.
Another listener says, Mr. Smiley only received a 30-minute segment. Poverty alone is itself deserving of an hour segment, and that is indeed true, but Tavis was only available to us for 30 minutes. So let's make that. I mean, this is a very busy man, and as you can tell, another listener writes, Tavis is spot on. Obama seems more like a moderate Republican to me. And let's hear from some more of you, and we'll go to San Rafael. Peter, hi.
Hi, I'm wondering about the connection that Tavis could make between the poverty and the violence. It seems like Sandy Hook gets a lot of attention, but every day in this country, young black men are killing each other, and they have been for two decades, and now we have a young black man as president, and nobody seems to care.
I couldn't agree more. In the tradition of the black church, I would just say amen, not a whole lot to add to that. And that's precisely why, you know, many, many weeks ago, I wrote a piece. I was asked to write a piece for the Huffington Post, wrote a blog for them, Michael, where I talked about this and where I made the point that black people had better speak up now, lest there be blood on our hands. Why? Because black people end up, black children specifically, after Sandy Hook, black children are the disproportionate victims of violent crime. So I hate the fact that it took Sandy Hook to get this conversation in this conversation. What I even hate even more, I think, is that there seems to be a different valuation of the worth of a black life and a white life. When I say that, that always rankles people and gets me into trouble. But here's the point, that this happens to black kids in inner city America every single day. Look at what the people in Chicago on the South Side had to do. They started a letter writing campaign. They had a protest march. They did a media campaign in Chicago to beg the president to come home. You mentioned Jesse Jackson earlier. He led this with other leaders. They had to beg the president to come back to Chicago to say words about Hadiya Pendleton, who a young girl who had performed in his inauguration and died a week later. You know the story. It made national news. But he didn't get to Chicago nearly as quickly as he got to Sandy Hook. So the question is, what is it about life that makes it different for us? I think that all life is precious. All life is valuable. I value those precious and priceless children in Sandy Hook as much as I value the kids in Oakland or in Chicago. And we've got to take this issue more seriously. So the entire nation needs to raise its voice, but particularly and especially those who are the disproportionate victims of this crime. But you don't hear a whole lot of that. Again, even when life is lost, too often my own community is too deferential to this president.
Let me get one more caller on, and that's you, Tyrone. Good morning.
Good morning to both of you, Tavis, for you, and Dr. West. I just want to applaud both of you for the poverty tours that you do. Poverty seems to have been just brushed aside for the last 20, 25 years. And my question is, what can we do from the bottom up? I mean, I'm in the streets all the time, mm-hmm. and it just seems like it's getting worse every year.
Yeah.
And we keep looking for answers from the top down, and it doesn't appear to be happening from there. What can we do on the bottom?
Well, that was what the Occupy movement was supposed to be about in part, wasn't it, Tavis?
Yeah, it was. It was a shot in the arm, and there are people who were reminded that kind of protest does make a difference. I know your time is tight. My answer is this. One, and I'm not saying this to be shrill, but I think that in the book The Rich and the Rest of Us that I referenced earlier, we lay out a poverty manifesto of 10 things that every one of us can do. I don't have time to run the entire list right now, but in that book, The Rich and the Rest of Us, there is a list of things that we can do. But the short answer is we have to brighten the corner where we are. We have to assign ourselves. Every one of us has something that we can do right where we are to make a dent on this issue of poverty. Say nothing, of course, of pushing our leaders to say and to do more about it. But in that book, we detail for everyday people what we can do, Michael, to push back on the increasing poverty in this nation.
Well, we are, alas, out of time, but let me applaud you and Cornell for what you have done, carrying on really the spirit and the meaning of Dr. King's legacy. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Michael. Take care.
Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer, Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zoll, and executive producer, Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.